I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we are here with my guest, Tanya Lerman.
I think that the imagination is enormously important. This doesn't mean that things spiritual are imaginary. It means that you need to use your imagination to experience them, and that there's a cultivation of skill that goes along with that that can change people's lives.
Tanya Lerman is a psychological anthropologist and a professor in the Department of Anthropology at Stanford University. She received her education from Harvard and Cambridge universities and was elected as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2003. In 2007, she was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. Welcome, Tanya.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, and you have written, my goodness, four books so far,
yeah.
Three of which I've read.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, I heard you on Terry Gross on When God Talks Back.
Right.
But then when I went to look at what else you had written, I came to understand that you did your dissertation was on witchcraft
mm-hmm.
at Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting. And so you've also written a book called The Persuasions of the Witch's Craft.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned that your dad was a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote a book called Of Two Minds about American psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't take a look at The Good Parsi,
mm-hmm.
but that's perhaps less in the line of the three books than these three books. So what I want to talk with you about first, how did you come to anthropology?
Oh, I've always been interested in how things become real to people. And I started college as a philosophy major. That was my idea. And then in the way that freshmen can be very young and naive, I sort of decided that philosophy sort of was cheating because it kind of came...
Well, it was cheating?
Well, no. Because I mean, I remember feeling... I was very young. I was thinking about this when reading Kant because,
oh, yeah.
You know, there's this question of how do people share ways of seeing the world? So he just says that they do. He kind of postulates that there are these, you know, categories of the understanding and everybody has them and that's why people
see
it.
We are, therefore we do.
Yeah. And I became, and I was, you know, that it seemed to make a lot of logical sense, but it didn't seem to really explain things about people, although,
right.
Of course, now that I know more about psychology, in fact, there is something deeply Kantian in the way that the mind evolves. But in any event, I thought that people were... you really had to understand the kind of myths and the stories that people swam in culturally.
Mm-hmm.
And so I initially sort of studied folklore and mythology, and then I realized that if you wanted to really understand people, you had to ask those questions in anthropology.
Oh, okay, because I remember reading that your first paper, I think that you actually won an award for at
mm-hmm.
Harvard, was on the Popol Vuh, which
mm-hmm.
is the Mayan creative myth.
That's right.
So you found that in order to understand people, you had to understand their myths?
Well, I thought that... if the kinds of things that I wanted to understand were sort of the ways that people made sense of their world,
okay.
And I really wanted to know how things became real for people, and I was really interested in the things that were not obvious about the way that the world became real. So a classic cognitive psychologist might ask, you know, how do we, you know, see in three dimensions. How do you know, what's central to the visual perceptual process that enables us to all kind of coincide in the way that we interpret our world visually? I was interested in why people were so attached to ideas about God and ghosts and, you know, and how people were so different from each other. And that's the kind of thing that you explain really by, I thought, thinking about culture and thinking about myths. I thought that myths and narratives and stories were really important in orienting people to, you know, a view of their world.
And an inner world, right?
And an inner world. I thought the inner world was central.
Okay. And how people were correlating? their experience in the world, or coming together in groups, or all of the above?
Kind of all of it. I mean, I thought that people always looked out at their world from a particular way of experiencing and expecting, and they're all kind of, you know, we're all within little private bubbles, and it's kind of a miracle that we, you know, are human and interactive, and it's also kind of a miracle how differently people can experience something, how differently they can experience a human interaction, how differently they can experience, you know, something that is a source of joy to some people is a source of misery to others. I mean, I was always very curious about that.
And yet people seem to find validity in the experience that they are drawn to. Mm-hmm. I mean, that maybe that's kind of tautological, but anyway, I wanted to move on to Persuasions of the Witch's Craft, and I read that you had found yourself in England and thought, well, what an interesting study to make of paganism.
That's right. And one of the classic books in anthropology, particularly British anthropology, is Evans Pritchard's Witchcraft, Oracles, and Magic Among the Azande. So it's a study of a East African peoples, and is back in the 30s. And these are people who really organize their lives with ideas about witchcraft. So when something goes wrong, the explanation is that somebody's intentions have somehow caused it to go wrong. And they might not even know that it's their intentions. But somehow this mental action at a distance changes the world. So it's a great book, but it's easy to think about these ideas about mental action at a distance as associated with Africans or people who aren't in the Cambridge University, aren't us.
And they're culturally very...
They're very different.
Very different, right.
They're, you know, and you can say that at the time that Evans Pritchard was doing his work, they were mostly not literate. They were mostly not, you know, familiar with science.
Not much technology.
Not a lot of technology. So I had come across this world of magic. I'd actually come across this... there was a book in the Harvard University bookstore that I picked up on my way to England that was written by somebody who lived in Berkeley and taught you how to be a witch. And I thought that was pretty interesting because she was obviously very sophisticated.
Was the Starhawk's book?
Starhawk's book, exactly.
Yes. And I've interviewed Starhawk. She's really pretty remarkable person.
Yeah, it was a pretty remarkable book. But it was also intended to be read by smart, educated Westerners. Mm. So I arrived in graduate school talking to my advisors, and somebody said, oh, I know a witch. Or I know somebody who knows somebody who knows a witch. And the first person I met was a kind of prototypical English village witch. She lived in a, you know, 17th century cottage. She had a dozen cats. She had a cauldron and an altar and a knife stained with her own blood.
Oh, my gosh.
And so she was kind of amazing.
Yeah.
But she was just herself. She directed me to, well, you should meet so-and-so. And I went to this event, and there were like 100 people there, and they were all Cambridge, Oxford educated. And they also did this mental action at a distance thing. And I couldn't explain them away by saying that they were East African, undereducated. And so I was fascinated by how these ideas of magic became real to people, how people came to feel confident or reasonably confident that they would do a spell and the spell would have a consequence. So anthropologists go native and then they come back. So I joined a witch's coven. I joined a lodge of high magicians. I joined a group practicing Celtic magic.
And that was that the Order of the Golden Dawn, was it? Or
One of their descendants.
Oh, okay.
And so all of these groups had in common the idea, I mean, they were all kind of lovely lamb-like people. This was all kind of good magic.
Yes, white
some
magic.
Some of them weren't actually even Christians.
Okay.
And they all had this idea that there was this force in the world that science hadn't recognized, and you could use your mind to kind of manipulate it with the right symbols, and you could direct it to the right goals. And so I set out to figure out, not the question, does magic work? Why do they believe in it? But more, if you just say, what are they doing that enables them to experience the magic as real and as having an impact on the world? What do you see? And so that's what I initially was working on.
Right, right. Because you write, understanding how someone comes to find magic persuasive is roughly the same problem as understanding how someone can become a priest in a community of unbelievers.
Right. And so you are engaging in something that, you could call supernatural. Not everybody who's religious talks about God as supernatural. Sometimes they separate God from the supernatural.
Okay.
But it's some kind of presence in the world that is, that some other people cast doubts on.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you can make the argument that it's not scientifically demonstrable. And
not in the necessarily falsifiable, Popperian hypothesis sort of way.
Right.
Right. With the Karl Popper thing about it, about being able to falsify something, and if it can't be falsified, it's not valid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how much real falsification most of us do anyway, but in any event, there are people who are talking about this substance in the world, mm-hmm. and they are doing something with it, and if they come to this, and you can ask the question, so what are they learning? Independent of the truth of the substance, what are they learning to pay attention to that helps them to experience the substance as real? And the real thing that floored me with the magic and that came to be what I was most interested in with Christianity was that I thought that this project that on magic was going to be kind of a cognitive science project.
Mm-hmm.
I had this idea that sort of developed in my undergraduate days, that these myths and stories, they're really important. They shape the way you interpret the world. And so I thought that I would hang out with people practicing magic. I would learn that they had narratives and categories and ways of interpreting things, so that they would start to do these rituals, do these spells, and then they would interpret the world so that they would see that for themselves that the rituals had certain consequences. So, and I did see that. I mean, people would do a ritual about the sea, and they would have an idea of what the sea represented, and they do the ritual, and a day later, rain buckets, and they would say, "See, evidence, I stirred up the water." And so, they had a way of kind of finding that evidence. And so I saw that. But what I was really floored by is that they were very clear. If you practice magic, if you want to understand magic, you have to practice.
To really get into it.
You have to really get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And they would talk, and the practice that they did was using their capacity to imagine, things. So they sometimes even talked about this as Ignatian practice, and that's actually... Ignatian. Ignatius of Loyola, or Ignatius of Loyola.
Right.
They would use their minds to imagine things, then they would practice this imaginative skill, and they said you would get better at this, and that people who get better, they would change. And they would talk about their mental images getting sharper, and I also noticed that they would report odd experience. And so what really floored me was that I started doing these practices, and I started having odd experience, and I actually felt the magical power.
fascinating.
So, I mean, I'm not making a claim about whether there was magic, but I could feel it flowing through my body. So, and that I would, you know, and I once woke up early in the morning and I saw six druids standing by the window.
Yes, yes.
And
I read that.
I mean, it was kind of quite striking to me.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes, not very often, but I'd sometimes go to an event and it was like the words in the event became more real to me than the living room we were standing in. Something changed.
Yeah, we have to take a short break.
Sure.
I'm Anthony Wright, and I'm your host today on Attunement, and we are here with my guest Tanya Lerman, who has written a book. Her most recent book is called When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. And how can people contact you, Tanya?
At lerman.net.
And that's, can you spell it, please?
Oh, LUHRMANN.NET. And there I have a way for you to reach me. I also have a sense of presence forum where I'm trying to create a judgment-free place for people to talk about unusual experience and how they make sense of it.
Great. And we are here with my guest, Tanya Lerman, and she has written a book called When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. But we are talking about Tanya's first book called Persuasions of the Witch's Craft, Ritual Magic in Contemporary England. And before the break, Tanya, you were talking about how you actually felt the magic power come through you.
Yeah.
And you saw what you saw, the druids.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've read that you wrote, that when specialists get immersed in their specialty through experience, they find their practice progressively more persuasive through the very process of interpreting and making sense of their involvement. This
yes.
changing understanding may become progressively more opaque to outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
And in your involvement then, that's
yes.
what became more and more clear as
yes.
you joined them in the practice.
And so I would say that there were two things that I saw at work in the magical world. One was a kind of expertise that I think you see in any, you know, walk of life. You know, becoming a doctor, learning to recognize diseases, learning to hear in a certain way. You know, becoming, you know, when gymnasts become better gymnasts,
right.
they you know, I can tell that they see, when I watch gymnastics performance, I can't see all the twists and the turns, and I know the commentators can. They literally see more.
Mm-hmm,
so that's part
mm-hmm.
of it. You're looking out at the world a different way. I also thought that there's a bodily dimension to this, and that's obviously there, true for gymnastics, but what it was in magic was that I think when you use your mind and you really practice using your imagination and you're also coming to experience your body a little differently. And so I think there's a range, both your imagination does get sharper and it becomes more vivid. I think it feels more real. And I also think that there's a host of other spiritual experiences that we see around the world in many different faiths that also you probably, you can use this in different ways. You might say you become more attuned to them. And a secular way of describing that would be to say that we have a lot of things happen in our world, in our bodies, and if you become aware of them and look for them and pay attention to them, you might elaborate them and give them more meaning and allow them to become more real in your life. So I think the example of feeling magic moving through my body is one example of that. So people have that sense. You could call it an adrenaline rush. So people who
But it's visceral.
Yeah, a visceral experience.
Okay.
And I think sometimes people have those experiences and they call them the Holy Spirit. Sometimes we know that there's an experience called sleep paralysis. The witches don't talk about that. My Christians didn't talk about it. It's a real phenomenon. So it's you're asleep, and you sort of wake up, and you're sort of still, your body's still asleep, but your mind's alert, and you sometimes feel that you have this heavy weight on your chest. So that's a real, I mean, it's a phenomenological experience. In other words, people report some experience like that around the world. But in Southeast Asia, they look for it, they know about it, they name it, they give it all this really rich meaning, usually negative meaning.
Oh.
And it, in Cambodia, people say that this can kill you. Huh? And if you talk to Southeast Asians, they'll talk about that experience much more and report it more often than Americans will. So there's some kind of interaction between what you're looking for, what comes naturally in the body, and what you train your body to experience that I think shapes spiritual experience in a deep way.
It's interesting the parallels that I saw between the three books. One of the things that pops out at me at the notes that I took, magicians feel their ideas are compatible with science and that the larger society around them assumed the incompatibility.
Mm-hmm.
But to compare these rationalizations with the rationalizations of another activity that feels threatened, i.e. Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that came that I also was very interested in that's sort of related to this is, would you talk about interpretive drift?
Yes. So I saw that among the magicians. They didn't come to their magical practice usually with the idea that magic was real.
Right.
They usually started with the idea, I'll try this out. I'll see if it works.
Yeah.
And they would begin spending time in rituals. They would read books. They would hang out. And they would pay attention. And gradually, the magic would become more and more real to them. And it didn't seem to me like it was a conscious choice. It was more as if the way that they made sense of their world sort of drifted so that they would begin to notice things in a different way. They would feel things in a different way. Experiences that they might not have paid attention to before, now they did pay attention to. And so that sense of having the world change on you, not because you were choosing, but because it was happening. You see this in Christianity as well, but it feels a little different because often when people become Christians, they make a decision at the beginning. And so that changes
things. And they make a real commitment to that path, and they say, well, this is what we're going to do here. But so the witch is kind of more drifted into it.
Yeah. And you can see it in psychiatry. So young psychiatrists, you know, they know that there's this condition called depression.
Right.
They have it written out in a diagnostic manual. They're introduced to people who have depression. But when they start out diagnosing somebody with depression, they're really anxious. They don't know quite what it consists of. They read all the symptoms in the diagnostic handbook. They ask somebody about them. A year into being young psychiatrists, they see depression. It's real. They can spot it when it walks through the door.
Oh. So it's not necessarily something that arrives cognitively.
No.
What a notion.
I mean, your cognition is important.
Yeah.
But there's this whole much richer way of making sense of your world that involves the way all these cues that you're picking up from people. Psychiatrists talk about smelling psychosis. There's all this stuff that's in the diagnostic handbook.
It's probably not talked about very much either.
Yeah, let's talk to clinicians.
Way.
Right, clinicians kind of talk about
it.
And of course, you know, there are all these checks and balances in the world of magic and psychiatry and Christianity.
Right.
But there's something about the way that you pay attention differently and your body responds differently and different patterns in the world suddenly kind of crystallize and You smell them, you feel them, you know them, you respond.
It seems like that there is then an underlying shift in the neural net.
Probably.
That goes along with the context.
Yes.
That one is continually exposed to, mm-hmm. and gets more and more refined with feedback loops from one's peers.
Absolutely.
And you found that happening in yourself in all three studies.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So that in a way we could say then, in a generalized sort of way, that when we pay attention to something that we really love, whether it be witchcraft or Christianity or flower arranging,
mm-hmm. That's right.
There gets to be a greater and greater sensitivity to the nuance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the degree of immersion in the pattern.
Yes. And you actually...
And the refinement of the immersion in the pattern, so that...
Absolutely.
There can be... And that's probably also what I suppose is recognized as levels of expertise, mm-hmm. within a field.
Yes. There's this famous study that was done with chess back in the 70s. And there's this... they find... You sort of can ask the question, what goes along with being a grandmaster, a really good chess player?
Right. But before the break, Tanya, you were beginning to talk about a study that was done with grandmasters in terms of developing a real in-depth, nuanced, refined sensitivity to whatever it is we're studying. So please continue with that.
So as I remember the study, they asked novice chess players and expert chess players to look at a board and remember it. Look at a chess board and remember it.
Right.
And if it was a real move, the experts could remember much more than the novices. If it was a false move, if the chess pieces were moved around in a way that you couldn't get them there by really playing chess,
oh, okay.
They had no better skills. But if they...
Really?
But if it was a real move... They could remember much more detail. And the argument was, and this is, I think, probably true, that experts sort of chunk knowledge in complicated ways so they actually remember more patterns. So what I saw in the this more religious domain, though, was not only that you have this chunking of patterns, and so people see, so like in Christianity, for example, people... who go to their Bible studies, they're constantly seeing examples of the prodigal son. They're constantly seeing the Good Samaritan. So they have all these biblical stories, and when they have events in their lives, they remember those events with biblical stories. And when you talk with them about the biblical story, so in a house group, so many of these churches have small groups, and
large are you talking?
Seven people. Once a week.
Very intimate.
Very intimate. A group of some of people will meet together and drink tea and talk about the Bible. And they do something that's a little odd. You know, you'll talk about the prodigal story of the prodigal son, where, you know, the younger brother takes his inheritance and goes off and squanders it, and then comes back and the father throws a big party for him. And the elder brother, who's been loyal at home, gets really aggrieved. So when I came to the house group at first, I was like, gee, where did this story come from? And why did the author of this text include it? And, you know, why are some of these stories included in all of the Gospels and not all of them are? And how do we think about that? And in the house group, other members of the group would say things like, this happened to me just this afternoon. God is doing that in my life. And so they're taking these stories that are written hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Right.
And they're using their own life to make sense of those stories, and they're shaping their own life with those stories.
Oh, so they're not only projecting meaning onto the translations, actually, of these texts, but they're finding meaning.
Yes. So you'll be sitting with somebody who's reading like the most obscure passage of Judges, and you're thinking, how are we doing with this? And somebody says, yeah, just this afternoon or just this morning, this helps me re-understand something. And you can see that also in, so that's a cognitive story. You could also see it in the way that people experience their mind. So, and this is actually a very old idea in the church, that Augustine talks about this, that when you are praying, you're trying to replace your human fears, your human ideas with ideas from Scripture. You're trying to replace your ordinary memories with memories of being with Jesus. You're trying to...
Really?
There's a lovely book by an historian, Mary Carruthers, called Crafting Thought, and she argues that the medieval clerics were actually trying to craft every thought so that it was of God, it was godly, it was full of Scripture, rather than being human. And they had,
As a way to be in harmony with God? Or?
Yeah. And there's this, and people actually do some of this cognitively.
Yeah.
And so there's these prayer practices that people use when they are trying to, in the evangelical church, they're walking with Jesus, they're having coffee with Jesus, they are, sometimes they'll throw themselves into the Bible, and so like a story like the Good Samaritan, so that, you know, somebody stops with and cares for somebody who is in pain, who's not of their group. They are trying to, or the Annunciation. Mary learns she's going to have a baby.
Right.
And you're asked when you're praying about this to imagine what Mary's face looks like. Well, you're borrowing, as you do that, you're borrowing your own memories of young girls and what their anxiety looks like, or what their joy looks like, or what their anger looks like, or whatever. And you are, you're trying to imagine, okay, well, was she outside and was it the desert, or was she in her house and what did that look like? And you're borrowing from your own memories. And your memories then get also soaked with the idea, their association with Mary.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and I remember hearing some of this sort of like came into play a little bit in the false memory debates about how memories can be influenced from many different sources and colored. And people just really are very firm about the reality of their memory.
Absolutely.
So that there are these feedback loops.
Right. And so if you think about it, not in terms of, did your dad molest you, but more, if you're a good Christian, you're a good magician or a good psychiatrist for that matter, as you're progressing through your day and you're becoming more and more skilled, the way that you think and interpret and experience is just soaked with this expertise.
That is sort of self-resonant.
Yeah.
In the field within which you are immersed.
Right.
And you talk about patterns, too, and it seems like that there are, and my study is in complexity science, and there are patterns within patterns and within patterns.
Right.
And it seems like people are going into these.
Right.
At ever refined levels. You spoke about chunking knowledge. Can you talk to us a little bit about that, what chunking knowledge is?
So it means that when you think about a particular thing, it can actually hold, you're remembering one thing.
Right.
But it's holding many more patterns for you.
Oh, right.
So if you, if you're a psychiatrist and you think depression, you don't have to work to remember that there are 9 criteria and you need to have 5 out of, a client needs to have 5 out of the 9 of them for 2 weeks, and one of them must be, I think it's depressed mood or whatever it is. It's you just know that. That comes along with the category of depression.
So you have access to it as kind of an intuitive sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's it comes to you. You don't have to work to retrieve it. And so when you think about...
Because you've been hanging out in that terrain.
Yeah, and you wreck it, the pattern just sort of feels very... So it feels intuitive to you.
Okay.
It feels as if it comes automatically. But when you think about... You know, I think I saw this happening when people talked about hearing God speak.
Hmm.
So people, they come into these churches where people seek an intimate relationship with God. And they come in and they say, I don't know what this means. Would you, so-and-so, would you talk to God for me because he never talks to me? And the person will say, no, God is always talking. You have to learn how to recognize him.
Uh-huh.
And the person needs to be taught how to look for God in their mind. They need to, you know, so what the church will say, God is talking to you all the time. You just need to find, you know, what's the thought, what's the mental image. This is how you recognize it. And they give you this sort of invite you to recognize it. So, you know, so what are the rules of discernment? Well, something pops into your mind. It's, you know, it has the character of God, which in this case means it's really, really good and loving, and God doesn't
tell
you.
It's differentiated from a demon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or from, you know, from the God of the Hebrew Bible, so who was not always a totally loving guy.
No, right.
And does this, does having this thought give you peace? Does it seem to be confirmed by other things going on in the world? But what I saw was that, so the church gives people these recognition strategies. People would struggle at the beginning, and they would, you know, is God really talking to me? And they would sort of combine that with experiences in their body. I always get tingling when God speaks to me, or when the Holy Spirit is present, mm-hmm. I feel kind of warm.
Oh, okay.
And they start to have these sort of their own personal recognition strategies. And they report, at, you know, three months, 2 years later, I don't know, so it's some chunk of time, that they just know it was God. Now, in practice, they're actually much more thoughtful than that suggests. So there are, when somebody says to me that they heard God speak, the church is always really alert to the fact that it might not be God, it might be just their own desires. And so I found when I talked to people, they would remember there were a couple of times that they were really, really confident of, or maybe 10 times, you know, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but there's a lot of gray area. And so...
Yeah, how do you know? I mean...
So you don't.
Oh, okay.
I mean, so, and the church is... I mean, so sometimes people are really confident, and particularly if it comes with one of those very powerful spiritual experiences, not only gives you peace, but you heard God audibly speak to you, and it was really at exactly the right time.
So there's a synchronous quality about it.
There's a synchronous quality.
Yeah.
You know, your mom and dad are getting divorced, and you're terribly, terribly upset, and maybe I'm thinking of somebody who was about 10, and wakes up in the middle of the night, and he feels that God tells him, I love you. And it was almost with his ears, but it wasn't quite, but it was really strong, and it was really emotionally pertinent. And he explained to me that he knew that that was God. Now, he has conversations with God a lot. After that, you know, is this just his interpretation? Is it not? He felt really confident about that.
One of the things that, and you talk about yourself as a psychological anthropologist, and again, to go over this, to a belief in God is like learning a skill in doing something. It's a training of the mind.
Right.
Would you talk to us about absorption?
Okay.
That you speak about in When God Talks Back.
So absorption is the name given to what I think is the capacity to be caught up in your imagination. It's an ability, you ask people about this, there's a psychologist called Aoki Telligan,
came up with a
scale, and it asks a bunch of questions like, you know, around whether you sometimes experience the world the way you did as a kid,
ah.
And, you know, whether you like to watch clouds change shape in the sky, things like that. And it's, and you know, it's a series of statements, and you say true, false. And I found out that the more statements you affirm, the more you're likely to experience God as a person, the more you're likely to report unusual spiritual experience, the more you're likely to report having an actual dialogue back and forth with God. It seems to be caught up with a lot. It also predicts, to use that kind of slightly awkward word, it's related to whether people are able to do these vivid, unscripted conversations with God that people talk about as prayer. And it seems also to people who are higher in absorption, they get better at those prayer practices.
Well, it's a skill you're talking about.
It's a skill.
Yeah. Because I remember also reading that this scale, of the absorption scale, was developed as a measure of hypnotizability.
Right.
So as a person who has some experience with hypnotherapy, I thought, well, now, is this just self-hypnosis?
You know, I think of this whole domain as six blind men around an elephant. You know, because there's something that the psychologists study called hypnosis, and that clinicians use called hypnosis. And there's something that, you know, writers do when they write, like good novelists, J.K. Rowling.
Yeah, they go into this altered state, man. Oh.
And is it called, you know, is it really an altered state? But their characters start telling them what to write down.
I remember hearing Stephen King tell stories about this,
yeah.
You know, that he was rather compelled to write his write his books by these figures.
Yeah. And psychiatrists talk about this as dissociation.
Yeah.
You know, it's people can go, anthropologists sometimes talk about it as trance. I think of absorption, I think of trance and hypnosis as these being these, you know, more extreme states. Whereas, I mean, anyone can get caught up in a novel.
Well, and you also talked about Csikszentmihalyi and the idea of flow in prayer.
Yeah.
Prayer. And before the break, Tanya, you were talking about the idea that Csikszentmihalyi speaks about in flow, mm-hmm. about the flow experience of prayer.
Right. So when people begin to pray and become comfortable at praying and good at praying, they often feel like the prayer happens through them, mm-hmm. and that they're not in charge, that God, somehow God is in charge. And the Holy Spirit moves through them, or God's words move through them, that they feel sometimes like conduits.
Because I was also looking at this idea of what you speak about in when God talks back as a sensory override.
Yes.
And so, is that sort of kind of what happens then? And tell us a little bit about that.
So what I mean by sensory override are these sensory experiences where people have an experience that they hear with their ears, or they see with their eyes, or they feel on their body.
That other people are not experiencing.
Okay. And that have no obvious cause. So,
okay.
So you hear a voice, but there's nobody. You don't see anyone who's spoken, or you see an angel's wing, but it disappears, and then there's no angel there. Or you feel a touch, but there's no person behind you. But it really feels like a sensory experience. So these are more common among people who are able to enter a state of flow or to become highly absorbed. Uh-huh. They don't always happen in that state, but they're somehow connected to them. They're not, I think, related to psychosis. I think that's a different phenomenon.
Well, yeah, because in the Of Two Minds book, you speak about the difference between this and between true psychosis, hallucination schizophrenia, which
that's
is how are those different?
So when somebody is has schizophrenia or is psychotic, when they have unusual sensory experiences, those experiences are often very common, so they can have them all the time or multiple times a day. Those experiences are often long. So they hear sentences or paragraphs or, you know, whole conversations, and what they hear is usually terrible.
Oh,
so
right.
People
yeah,
are spitting at them or telling them that they're jerks or they're just saying these terrible, damning things.
It's torturous. Yeah.
It's torturous, and the people actually feel the pressure of these voices. They feel them pushing in against their mind, and they hate it.
Yeah.
And people. And the folks I knew who had these other experiences, what I call sensory overrides, the experiences are brief. They last like four words. They are extremely rare. They have, you know, they can remember one or two or a small handful. And what they remember is good. It's pretty striking.
So it's generative in a positive way.
Yeah. I mean, it may kind of really startle somebody.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of them many of them happen in moving vehicles. And so somebody's driving along and they experience this as God speaks up from the back seat and says, I will always be with you.
Oh, boy.
So that's a little freaky. Somebody pulls off to the side of the road, but then they cry with joy.
Oh.
And
because it's such an emotionally...
Yes.
Overwhelming experience.
And so there's a lot that probably goes into that.
Yeah.
Probably the ambiguous noise.
Mm-hmm.
Probably some kind of emotional issue. People are very distressed about something or very excited about something. They're probably interpreting this pattern. I think it's completely compatible with an actual God also speaking. It's, you know, because you can ask the question, if God is always speaking, how come only some people hear? But they recognize a voice where they might not have heard a voice.
Oh, I see. Well, and it seems like that they are in having, and I imagine it happens more consistently with people who have been on the path longer.
I think so.
Because they have a greater, maybe a neural net context.
Right.
Or a way of making sense of something, or maybe a way of making meaning out of what they might think that they hear, or what they experience that they hear.
Right.
Yeah.
So I actually ran an experiment where I randomized people to prayer or non-prayer.
And okay.
I did this in a kind of Mickey Mouse kind of way. So everybody was randomized to an iPod. And
that's right. I remember reading
that. Yeah. And so some of people got lectures from the Gospels, and some people got these imaginative prayer-like experiences. And they did them for a month. So half an hour a day, 6 days a week for 4 weeks. And the people in the prayer condition reported more meaningful, unusual experiences. So it was really interesting.
Fascinating, yeah.
Yeah, so there were, in effect, we'd asked people to look for unusual experiences because we'd asked people before they began whether they'd ever had experiences like that.
Mm-hmm.
So if people had never had those experiences or had them like once a year or less often when they came back, they were much more likely to be in the prayer condition.
Mm-hmm.
If they, if you said, did they have a religious experience, they were more likely to be, I mean, there weren't many of these, I'm like six in a group of 100 people. They were, all but one of those was in the prayer experience. And if you just looked at all of the experiences, they were more likely to be if they were in their prayer condition, if they reported an unusual experience, it was more likely to be meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it's
there's some correlation there.
There's some story about your preparedness, your willingness to make meaning, your willingness to take the imagination seriously. I mean, I think you're really, I think that religion demands that you take your imagination seriously because you're being asked to say that what the world that you see before you is not all of the world that there is.
Right. Now, I did see something, and we're coming to the end of our time here. I'm so sorry. It's gone very fast. In both the study that you did of the Wiccan practitioners and the Christian practitioners, I didn't see it with the psychiatrist, but you said that there is an element of play.
Yes.
Tell us about finding that, and that the Christians are serious about their play or in earnest about their play.
Yes. So I thought both with the witches and the Christians that they encourage themselves to be playful about experiencing the more than natural, but the magic or God, and so with the Christians, they'll encourage that the pastors will encourage congregants to have a cup of coffee with God ask God what shirt they should wear in the morning, and you know the people who are doing this aren't confused about whether it's the same. You know, they don't think this is as serious as the Book of Acts, but it's a way for them to make God come more alive for them. To become more intimate.
Yeah.
And it gives them a space that's sort of between the world of tables and chairs and the world of fiction that is both kind of real but more than real, and it's sort of suspended between worlds. So it gives them a way for, I think of it as a way to help God become real in a world which is often skeptical about God.
Well, I'm so sorry we're at the end of our time, and if there was one thing that you wanted people to know about what you have been finding out about people.
I think that the imagination is enormously important. This doesn't mean that things spiritual are imaginary. It means that you need to use your imagination to experience them. And that there's a cultivation of skill that goes along with that that can change people's lives.
And I would also add that there's an open-hearted component to it as well.
I would say that.
Thank you so much for being with us. I hope to be able to talk with you again.
I'd enjoy that.
Great.
Thank you.